Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
It's been roughly 36 hours since Tyson Fury did what he did on Saturday night, and frankly, I still cannot believe it. There were a lot of different ways that fight could have gone, but I'm not sure anybody saw it going the way it actually did. The way it actually went was with Tyson Fury dominating every single second from the ring walk on the throne to the victory song in the ring. It was a massive performance, an incredible performance. He didn't just beat Deontay Wilder. He dominated him. He dominated the night. He dominated the weekend. And he put himself on top of his sport. Now, you knew something was about to happen when Tyson Fury turned his ring walk into a ring ride. Sitting on a throne in a red robe and a gold crown while singing Patsy Cline's Crazy.
Gentlemen, please be upstanding for your king. Tyson Fury!
Crazy. I'm crazy.
And like a king would, he has decided to be carried on a throne. I'm not sure what Patsy Cline's intent was when she released Crazy in 1961. But Tyson Fury has channeled every bit of it. In only the way he can.
In only the way he can. Like, if you do that and you get knocked out, at least you had one good moment. But if you do that and you knock out the previously unbeaten champ, the man many consider the most powerful puncher in heavyweight history, if you do that after riding in on a throne to that song, you're a freaking legend. And that's exactly what Fury did. And that's what he is now. He manhandled Wilder. That was a mugging, a curb stomping, a hospital job. Pick any phrase you want, and it applies here. And it started from the very first bell. Fury was quicker. He was faster. He was bigger. He was stronger. He was more aggressive. He was flat out better. And it wasn't even close. And no, he was not there just to use his superior boxing skills and stay out of the eye of the storm. In theory, it sounded suicidal, but he went right at Deontay Wilder, just as he said he would. So this was not about self-preservation or about using his superior boxing ability to outpoint Wilder or about doing everything in his power to avoid Deontay's lethal right hand. This was about putting a beating on Wilder and getting him out of there as quickly as possible. Or, as he told Mark Kriegel before the fight, quote, "I'm going to drag Wilder to somewhere he's never been before," end quote. And then he did just that, administering a severe beating on Deontay, and he dropped him in the third.
He's leaning on Wilder.
He floored him in the third, and then he did it again in the fifth.
His physical stature, it belies his skill and his
nimbleness.
Knockdown is scored! A body shot to Wilder!
You don't see that very often, right? He went downstairs, legitimately, legally, but a body shot put him on the canvas. By the sixth, it was pretty clear that that Wilder home run, it was not coming. You know, the ultimate equalizer, that right hand that could seemingly get him out of any bad spot was no longer there for him. Not when he had nothing left in his legs and no balance at all. Not when he was bleeding from his ear. Not when he had not landed a single meaningful punch since the early minutes of that fight. And not when he was dealing with a bigger, stronger, better man on that night. Then in the seventh, with Wilder trapped in the corner, taking a beating and unable to defend himself, his own corner had had enough.
Wilder just coasting back into that neutral corner, and now Fury's looking to split the guard as Wilder's in bad shape.
This fight is over.
This victory. There is only one. There is only one. Crown the king, the lone undefeated heavyweight champion of the world, Tyson Fury, the champion.
You know, I say that Wildest Corner had had enough, but it was really just one guy. And it's a good thing that he had and that he did something about it, which I will get to a little bit later on. Not right now, though, because this is not about Wilder. This is about Fury and what he did, which was pretty much whatever he wanted. And even crazier than that masterful, near-perfect performance is the fact that Fury called it. He told everyone exactly what he was going to do, and everyone thought he was crazy. Then he went right out, and he did it. He was not going to repeat what happened in that first fight. He was going to be the aggressor. He was not going to try to outbox Deontay Wilder. He was going to knock out Deontay Wilder. He was going to take the fight right to Wilder, which seemed completely insane, until he did it. And before he actually did it, that sounded like a guy. You know what it sounded like? It sounded like a guy trying to sell a fight, trying to get a few extra pay-per-view buys. You know, with the promise of a reckless attack on the guy with the most power in boxing history. I mean, who the hell would do that? No one's smart, especially when you had success outboxing him in the first fight. Why not stick to that script, maybe tweak it slightly, and then run it back? Turns out Fury did not like that script. He said he learned something in that first fight, and he wanted to put it into practice. Again, it sounded like he was selling tickets and moving pay-per-views. But that's not what it was. He went out, he brought in a new trainer. He put on more weight. He went to work. He took big risks in doing that. All those things would have made him look so bad if he got beaten. But turns out this guy was not crazy. He was smart as hell. He knew exactly what he was doing. He didn't come for a boxing match. He came for a brawl. And then he dominated. Before that fight, Fury told Kriegel that his father said it would be an easy fight. Correction, not an easy fight, but quote, one of the easiest fights you've ever had. Again, something else that sounded utterly ridiculous at that time, total hot air, a guy trying to convince himself of something. But it was true. That was one of the easiest fights that Fury's ever had. He wasn't remotely challenged or tested by Deontay this time around. Total physical, mental, and psychological domination. Right down to the moment where he appeared to be licking Wilder's blood off his neck. I guess because he wanted to taste his blood. I mean, by the way, what the hell was that? But then again, what was any of that? How do you explain a guy who goes 6'9", 273, who's able to move like that? Fury came in 16 pounds heavier than he was in the first fight, yet somehow he was quicker, more nimble. How do you explain that? But again, how do you explain any of this? How do you explain that? How do you square the guy who was leading a sing-along of American Pie in the ring after the fight? A guy who seemed like the life of the party with the guy who made truly horrific and offensive statements in recent years. I don't know. How do you explain that he was actually 400 pounds not that long ago? Four bills, legitimately. How do you explain that the guy who just did what he did was allegedly abusing cocaine and alcohol on a regular basis not that long ago? How do you explain that the guy that the world saw Saturday night was the same guy who said that it was not unusual to drink 18 pints of lager in a night? And that's before we get into any of his battles with depression and suicidal thoughts. A battle that was so crushing that at one point he said he got in his Ferrari, got it up to 190 miles per hour with the intention of ramming into a wall so he could kill himself. All of that was like less than 2 years ago. How does that guy become the most dominant fighter in boxing and do it in such fast order? How do you explain any of that? The answer is I can't. And if any of you can, I'd love to hear it. But I'm guessing if I can't, you can't either. I mean, I'm not even sure Fury can. But I do know this. That was one of the best performances by a heavyweight in decades. And while I did not expect it coming in, it didn't take long once that fight started to know it was going to end that way. That's how good he was. And if Fury shows up like that going forward, Anthony Joshua is going to have a real problem when it comes time to unify that division. Because if he fights the way he did Saturday night, and Joshua fights the way he did in that rematch with Andy Ruiz, Joshua's got no shot. In fact, less than no shot. And it really would then be the King's world. A world that he wanted no part of not that long ago. What an absolutely astonishing and incredible performance Saturday night in Vegas. Nearly everybody I know has trouble sleeping, and frankly, I'm no different. Do you fit into that? Are racing thoughts overtaking your night of sleep? Are you tired of not being able to sleep? Do you have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep? If so, it is time for you to try Ebb. If you've tried everything from pills to pillows with little success, it is time for you to try Ebb. Ebb is the first and only wearable, drug-free solution that targets the root cause of sleeplessness, the racing thoughts. Ebb applies precise and continuous cooling to the forehead, which calms your mind, and it's clinically validated. 4 out of 5 users report falling asleep faster and improving overall sleep quality. And Ebb allows people suffering from sleeplessness to drift more comfortably into a deeper, more restorative sleep. Ebb Sleep is designed to work with your natural sleep-wake rhythms to allow you to get into that deep sleep more quickly. Have the energy to do the things you love once again by getting the sleep you need. Ebb's natural solution has no morning side effects and allows you to get back to your peak performance. Right now, you can try Ebb risk-free for 60 nights to confirm that it is the solution that you've been looking for. Go to tryebb.com/Rome. That's TryEbb.com/Rome. Tryebb.com/Rome. Order today. Get the sleep that you need and the sleep you deserve. Kevin Ioli. Kevin, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
I am awesome, Jim. How are you doing today?
Great. Super, Kevin. Great to have you. Thanks so much for doing it. You know, if you and I were to go back to the build-up to the fight, in fact, you and I spoke before it, but when you looked at that first meeting, Kevin, what kind of a fight were you expecting to see Saturday night?
You know, a carbon copy of that with maybe a few small changes. You know, I did not think Fury was serious when he said he was going to go forward and back Wilder up. Now, that made a lot of sense, and I talked about that and I wrote about that last week, that the way you neutralize power is one of two things. You either box and move, which is what he did the first time, and create angles and that type of thing, or you try to back somebody up. And because boxers or power punchers are not able, Jim, to really do well when they're backing up. They're so used to being the person moving forward, trying to corner somebody, and then firing away. When they're forced to back up, they tend to not be as effective. So the strategy, that strategy made sense, but it was also risky because you're walking right into the guy's power. And so I know Fury said he was going to do that, and the hiring of Javon Sugarhill Stewart kind of suggested that might be the case. But I thought, you know what, he's going to do it a little bit, but more he's going to do the moving and create angles because he's such a good boxer. But he executed that plan as well as I've ever seen a boxer in a big fight execute a game plan. It was magnificent.
It was magnificent is right. I want to go back to that point in a minute, Kevin. I have to admit myself, when he said that, I thought he was just doing what he does, you know, running off at the mouth, trying to sell some pay-per-views, trying to sell some tickets, maybe even trying to convince himself of something. But as you point out, Kevin, and I was talking about this before he came on, he knew exactly what he was doing. And it's one thing to think it, but quite another to go out there and execute it. Let me ask you this. What was the mood like in the arena when he came out sitting on the throne, wearing a crown and singing Crazy?
It was epic. I mean, the place went nuts. There was a lot of intensity. They had done Sweet Caroline before, and all the Fury fans sang it. And so the promoters did a wonderful job with the way they presented the show. I mean, the arena looked great. The fans were totally into it. And that entrance by Fury was spectacular. Wilder had a good entrance, too, but I heard that Wilder had an entrance that he wanted to do that was going to cost a lot of money, and it ended up getting vetoed. They thought it cost too much money. I didn't get details on what it was, other than it was pretty over the top. Wilder's was good, but Fury's was just absolutely epic.
Kevin Ioli is joining us. Kevin, back to the point about how Fury could have gone in there. He's the better boxer. We know this. What's it say about him then that he could have just done what he'd done in the first fight, maybe had a better result because he would have been in better shape, but instead he did change trainers. He completely reworked his strategy, and he came back with a performance like that. What's that tell you about Fury?
That is what I wrote my post-fight column about, and I said, I looked at Anthony Joshua, the other guy that has heavyweight title belts, and I said, this is why you want to watch Tyson Fury more than you want to watch Anthony Joshua. And Joshua is a great talent, no doubt about it, but when Joshua was in a similar situation coming back to fight Andy Ruiz, what did he do? He fought cautious, he fought tentative, he didn't, you know, and forget, you know, this is just personality difference, but he didn't do a great job, you know, promoting the fight. Fury did that. Fury said, you know what, I'm going to take a risk, and I might get knocked out by taking this risk, but I'm going to give the fans a show. I'm going to win definitively. I'm going to show that I believe in my skills. Joshua was afraid of Andy Ruiz. There's no question about it. An out of shape, guy who was 20 or 30 pounds overweight. I think that that shows the difference between those two guys. Fury believes in his talent, believes in his ability, and knows, you know what, I am good enough to make this work. Joshua kind of doesn't have that same confidence in himself. And I'll tell you, if you only had money to buy a ticket to see one of the two of them, there's no question right now who the majority of people would rather watch.
No doubt. Kevin Ioli is my guest. Kevin, how do you explain a 6'9", 273-pound man moving the way Fury moves?
He is a rare athlete, but, you know, he comes from a fighting family, and he started young, and I think that's part of it. It's kind of like Floyd Mayweather. You know, Floyd Mayweather was 18 years old, and he had gloves on his hand. He was in the ring for the first time at 3, and I think that's a similar thing with Tyson Fury. His father was a fighter. Other people throughout his lineage had fought over the years, and he just grew up with boxing, and, you know, when you learn that early, that footwork, those movements, even when you become so big and so overwhelming where you think that he would be bumbling and stumbling around the ring, you're able to make those movements, and he understands boxing at such a high level, and he looks at it differently than anybody else. It's almost, to me, the comparison I would make, Jim, is the way Wayne Gretzky used to see the plays happening on the ice when he was in hockey. It was almost like Gretzky was watching from the press box, seeing people move, and I think Fury has that kind of sense of movement in the ring. He understands, if I do this, he's going to do that, and that's going to be the result. It's just brilliant, and I think it comes from a lifetime of being involved in the sport.
Really interesting. Like, Gretzky knew where the puck was going to be before it went there, so maybe Fury sees things before they happen. But let me ask you this. You can explain that like that, but how do you explain this? It was not that long ago, and you've written on this, that Fury was 400 pounds. He was abusing drugs and alcohol, battling depression. He had suicidal thoughts. How do you explain this dramatic a turnaround and this quickly?
It's almost impossible. I mean, that is so remarkable, and I think it's just a testament to the person that he is, and I think it should be a symbol to people who are suffering. I mean, hey, I think one of the reasons this fight caught on, hey, there are two great fighters who had contrasting styles and were exciting fighters. That's the main reason. But you know what? They also related to people on a human level, because both of them, I put a story out, I interviewed Deontay Wilder last month, and he admitted he had a gun in his hand, was thinking of committing suicide when he was 19 years old. Tyson Fury, you know, not only did he have suicidal thoughts, Jim, he was in a sports car going 150 kilometers an hour thinking of driving into the side of a bridge. So he actually was taking action, and then he said a voice spoke to him and said, don't do this. And so he put on the brakes and managed not to wreck his car and survive, and he sought help. And the fact that he got help from mental health professionals also is so good for other people, because it shows, you know what, there's help out there. Even when it seems like it's the worst, there's help out there. But it's a remarkable story that he's done. And I have no doubt that there will be books and movies written about this long into the future.
No doubt. Kevin Ioli, my guest. Kevin, what was your reaction when Jay Deese let the world know that Mark Breland was the guy who threw in the towel?
Well, I had two reactions. Number one, I was stunned that he would throw his longtime partner under the bus like that. And number two, I thought it was classless. Mark Breland absolutely made the right call. When you're hired as a fighter's trainer, these guys are warriors. They don't want to quit. They're going to keep going. They always believe in their ability. They hire you as the trainer to protect them. They need you to make the call that they don't want to make. And Deontay Wilder had no chance to win that fight at that point. And I think from the fifth round on, Jim, his legs were gone. You know, so if you don't have your legs as a boxer, you're not going to win. And he didn't have the power that he originally came into the ring with. And I think the fact that JD would throw Mark Breland under the bus like that was reprehensible. And I think he did it because he was just trying to kiss up to Deontay, because Deontay has the attitude, hey, I don't want you to stop my fights. But that's the trainer's job. I see my guy getting beaten on. He's taking right hands. He's taking left hooks. He cannot defend himself. He's going to have head trauma if this fight goes anymore. Mark Breland did 100% the right thing, and JD should be ashamed of himself.
Kevin Ioli with some strong comments. I agree. Mark Breland, first of all, if anybody would know, it's Mark Breland. He's been in that spot before. And number two, it's not a matter, Kevin, of him quitting. The guy showed compassion. He was looking out for his fighter. And to me, that was actually a courageous thing to do, because he had to know he was going to take heat, and he has.
Right.
So what do you make of now Deontay Wilder? You never really know how a fighter is going to respond to their first loss. So if you had to guess, how do you think Deontay responds to this?
I think Deontay's a winner, and I think Deontay is a true professional, and I think he'll come back strong. I think if his team does him a favor. They would advise him to turn down the rematch. He will get another rematch, fight with Tyson Fury. There's no doubt. But this immediate rematch, I think, would be a mistake. I think what he needs to do, Jim, is take, you know, 6 months off, no boxing, no promoting, just go out and relax and let his body heal, let his mind heal, and then get back into the gym. And I think that'll do a couple things. That'll open the way for potentially a Fury Joshua fight, which would then create an undisputed champion. And then number two, it would allow Wilder to kind of, you know, work on some things that he needs to work on and just get his body back to full health. Fighters often after a fight like that are never the same, and it's usually because they get back into the gym and they get back into the ring too quickly. If you let yourself heal, you'll be fine. That would be my advice to him. You know what? Don't rush back into this. You'll get him next year. You'll get him down the line, but right now the most important thing is your health.
Kevin Ioli, my guest. So final thought, you shared your concerns about Joshua, but what about a potential Fury-Joshua fight? Just how big would that be?
I think you would be talking, if they put that in Las Vegas, and I think at Allegiant Stadium where the Raiders are going to play, you know, you're going to talk about 70,000 people being there. You know, 30, 40, 50,000 Brits would come over. I think that they could have a record gate at that stadium, or if not, certainly close to it. Mayweather-Pacquiao in 2015 had a $72 million gate, and I think that that would be certainly be threatened, if not broken. And from a pay-per-view standpoint, I think it would be massive. It would be a huge event around the world, and I think it's the absolute fight to make. It would be the Ali Frazier of this generation.
But Kevin, don't you wonder about Joshua though? Like Fury, it's very clear that he loved the big stage. He's comfortable on the big stage. How do you think Joshua would deal with that promotion and the build up and the lead up to like the biggest thing ever?
You know, that's not his thing. Like, Fury's comfortable in front of the camera, and Joshua is not. But I also think what's happened is his team has done him a disservice. They haven't put him. I mean, he is a bright guy, and he has a lot to say. He's just not a comedian like Tyson Fury is. But he has a lot to offer, but I think his team just, you know, they protect him, and it's almost like, you know, they're afraid of losing their gigs, and so, you know, he doesn't like to do promotion, so they don't force him to do it. But I think what needs to happen with some of these people is say, hey, you know what, it's only going to be in your best interest, and you're a smart guy who has a good story to tell. Let's set it up for you. I don't know that against Tyson Fury you're going to win the battle of words with him, but I think he could present himself in a very positive way. He's beloved by the Brits, but not so much by anybody else. And I think if the people got a chance to know the real Anthony Joshua and he would show that side of himself, you know, that would just help his brand going forward, not only in the UK, but in the U.S. and around the world.
Kevin, to me, it's kind of like fighting Conor McGregor. You're not going to win the presser. You're not going to win the run-up to the fight. You're not going to win the promotional aspect
right.
of it, but you might win in the cage. You might win in the ring.
That's what you got to try to do, and you know, present yourself in a good way. That's what you have to do, and I think Anthony could do that. But my guess would be, you know what, he's going to just say, let Tyson do all the interviews, and I'm going to worry about training, and I don't think he'll put his best foot forward.
Kevin Ioli covers boxing and MMA for Yahoo Sports, and again, a good friend of the program. Kevin, thank you very much for that hit, and for all of them, it's good to have you back.
Anytime, Jim. Appreciate you having me. Thanks.
As good a night as that was for Tyson Fury, it was that tough of a night for Deontay Wilder. Absolutely nothing worked for him on Saturday night because he got worked. That was about as one-sided a rematch of a draw as you could possibly imagine. He was really never in that fight. Fury stepped to him, controlled the space, controlled the ring, closed him down, never gave him a chance to get into that fight. Never really even gave him a chance to get his feet or legs underneath him. And he was not afraid to use the 273 pounds in the clinch and make Deontay hold him up. Fury was not just a better boxer Saturday night. He was the better and more powerful puncher. It was clear from the very jump, and it only got worse for Deontay as the fight went on. After the fight, Wilder made reference to the fact that he had, quote, a lot of things going on heading into this fight, end quote. And he said it more than once. I'm not sure what he meant by that, but I'm also pretty certain that whatever it was, it didn't matter. He was not going to beat that version. Not that version of Fury on that night, period. Because again, Fury never let Deontay get into a rhythm. Never got the space or the looks he wanted. And he just stayed after Wilder from bell to bell. He put so much pressure on him. He took away his legs and then he sapped him of his superhuman strength. Wilder looked like he was in deep from the second round on. And from the time Wilder went down in the third, it had that feeling of a night where Wilder's only chance was to land that miracle shot a shot that simply was not coming. By the fifth, he was in real danger. Not of just losing the fight, that was already a given, but he was in real danger of being in real danger, of possibly being seriously hurt. At that point, Fury is just, or I should say Deontay is just taking unnecessary punishment because he's unable to defend himself and he's incapable of landing any significant shots. And that continued on into the seventh when Fury continued to do damage and Wilder could not get off the ropes.
Wilder just coasting back into that neutral corner, and now Fury's looking to split the guard as Wilder's in bad shape. This the fight is over. Deontay Wilder's corner was throwing in the towel. The ref stepped in. He is battered. He is bloody. And that's the baddest man.
And that's when assistant trainer and former fighter Mark Breland threw in the towel. And as you might surmise, Deontay was not happy about that at all.
Things like this happen. The best man won tonight, but my coach, my side, threw in the towel. And, you know, I'm ready to go out on my shield, man.
I get it. I understand why he'd be angry about that. I understand why he'd be upset about that. A lot of fighters, especially fighters with that kind of heart, would be pissed in that situation. Deontay is extremely proud. It's a courageous guy. He didn't want somebody to end that fight for him. He didn't want to go out like that. He wanted to go out like a warrior. And by the way, he's still a warrior. 100%. Except in that case, going out like a warrior could have a terrible impact on your career. And more importantly, on your entire life. Going out on your shield is a figure of speech. But if that had gone on any longer, he might have gone out on a stretcher, or even worse, in a pine box, because that's the kind of beating that he was taking. But Wilder was not the only guy in his own camp who was angry about that. His head trainer, Jay Deese, was as well. And he wanted everybody to know that it was Mark Breland who threw in the towel and not he himself.
Mark threw the towel. I didn't think he should have. Deontay's the kind of guy that's a go-out-on-his-shield kind of guy, and he would tell you straight up, don't throw the towel in. In fact, in the dressing room when Tyson was getting his hands wrapped, in one of the earlier fights, which they show on the screen in the locker room, they had a guy that got stopped. We were like, stop the fight. And right when the ref stopped the fight, the towel came in, and Tyson looked at his people and said, never. Like that. And I said, yeah, that's the same kind of guy Deontay is. He does not want that. And then you've always got to consider also that Deontay is a fearsome puncher. So that's always a difficult thing because, you know, he does always have that shot to land a big shot and turn things around. So that's what happened there. But Deontay is doing well and, you know, he'll be back. He'll be all the better for it.
Quote, he'll be all the better for it. Yeah, if he is, let's be clear about this. If he is all the better for it, it's because Breland threw in the towel. Not in spite of that. D said that Wilder could have turned that fight around. Look, I understand that your head trainer is going to have that kind of confidence in you, that faith in you. I get that. I understand it. I respect it. But you know what I respect even more? Breland for throwing in the towel. Because it's not just about having blind faith in your fighter. It's about caring for your fighter as well and making sure that he is there for the next fight. Of course, Deontay Wilder wanted to continue. Almost every fighter does. That's why it's up to the corner and the ref to protect the fighter from himself. To protect the fighter when he's no longer capable of protecting himself. Protect the fighter when he's not capable of defending himself. Because at that point, Deontay Wilder wasn't. And he was taking hellish punishment that could have had long-term detrimental effects in a fight that at that point, he had absolutely no shot of winning. No, I'm not a doctor, but no, I don't need to be one to know that. And had Breland not acted the way he did, when he did, Wilder may have ended up losing a hell of a lot more than that belt. And back to the other argument that Deese made. Save this argument that Wilder can end any fight at any time with that right hand, so you gotta let him try. On most nights, yes, but not on that night. Not this past Saturday night. That was not his fight. He was not the better fighter. And deep down, he knew it. Fury knew it. Pretty much everybody knew it, except for Jacksonville Bob, who's slabbergasted.
Flabbergasted.
The point that I'm trying to make is this. I'm as intoxicated by that right hand as anybody. That Hail Mary shot, though, that home run shot, was not coming on that night. He didn't have the power necessary to throw it. He didn't have the energy or the legs to load and land it. And whatever he did have left, even if he could land it, was not moving a 273-pound Fury off his spot. By the seventh round, even standing up was a major accomplishment for Deontay. Most people, even most fighters, would have been done by then. Problem is, at that point, Deontay was not really a threat to anybody other than himself. Breland knew it. He's a former fighter. He's in that corner. He was watching the whole thing. He knew it. The ref knew it. The entire world knew it. Breland was not throwing in the towel to quit. Throwing in the towel was not quitting. It was being realistic. It was being smart. It was being compassionate. Hell, it was being courageous. That took guts. It would have been reckless for Breland and the rest of that corner to sit there and do nothing and just say that Deontay didn't want it like that. Deontay always had that puncher's chance. Man, what if something seriously, seriously bad had happened to him in that fight? And that was your explanation. Well, he didn't want to stop. You got to protect the guy from the guy sometimes. It is the corner's job to protect him when he can't protect himself. That's exactly what Breland did. He should be praised for it and not hammered for it. I understand that Wilder might be pissed, but that was the right call. Breland was the one who made it. Better to have wounded pride than a damaged brain. Instead of cracking him, we should be thanking him. And I think in time Wilder will. I think Deontay will. I think Deontay will know in time, if he doesn't already, that that absolutely was the right call. Are you craving some protein after a good workout? Of course you are. This time, don't make a shake, don't eat a bar, grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper instead. Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. It goes with you wherever you go, to the game, to the gym, to the beach, anywhere at all. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Kevin Ioli. Kevin, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
I am awesome, Jim. How are you doing today?
Great. Super, Kevin. Great to have you. Thanks so much for doing it. You know, if you and I were to go back to the build-up to the fight, in fact, you and I spoke before it, but when you looked at that first meeting, Kevin, what kind of a fight were you expecting to see Saturday night?
You know, a carbon copy of that with maybe a few small changes. You know, I did not think Fury was serious when he said he was going to go forward and back Wilder up. Now, that made a lot of sense, and I talked about that and I wrote about that last week, that the way you neutralize power is one of two things. You either box and move, which is what he did the first time, and create angles and that type of thing, or you try to back somebody up. And because boxers or power punchers are not able, Jim, to really do well when they're backing up. They're so used to being the person moving forward, trying to corner somebody, and then firing away. When they're forced to back up, they tend to not be as effective. So the strategy, that strategy made sense, but it was also risky because you're walking right into the guy's power. And so I know Fury said he was going to do that, and hiring of Javon Sugarhill Stewart kind of suggested that might be the case. But I thought, you know what, he's going to do it a little bit, but more. He's going to do the moving and create angles because he's such a good boxer. But he executed that plan as well as I've ever seen a boxer in a big fight execute a game plan. It was magnificent.
It was magnificent, is right. I want to go back to that point in a minute, Kevin. I have to admit myself, when he said that, I thought he was just doing what he does, you know, running off at the mouth, trying to sell some pay-per-views, trying to sell some tickets, maybe even trying to convince himself of something. But as you point out, Kevin, and I was talking about this before he came on, he knew exactly what he was doing. And it's one thing to think it, but quite another to go out there and execute it. Let me ask you this. What was the mood like in the arena when he came out sitting on the throne, wearing a crown and singing Crazy?
It was epic. I mean, the place went nuts. There was a lot of intensity. They had done Sweet Caroline before, and all the Fury fans sang it. And so the promoters did a wonderful job with the way they presented the show. I mean, the arena looked great. The fans were totally into it. And that entrance by Fury was spectacular. Wilder had a good entrance too, but I heard that Wilder had an entrance that he wanted to do that was going to cost a lot of money, and it ended up getting vetoed. They thought it cost too much money. I didn't get details on what it was, other than it was pretty over the top. Wilder's was good, but Fury's was just absolutely epic.
Kevin Ioli is joining us. Kevin, back to the point about how Fury could have gone in there. He's the better boxer. We know this. What's it say about him then that he could have just done what he done in the first fight, maybe had a better result because he would have been in better shape, but instead he did change trainers. He completely reworked his strategy, and he came back with a performance like that. What's that tell you about Fury?
That is what I wrote my post-fight column about, and I said, I looked at Anthony Joshua, the other guy that has heavyweight title belts, and I said, this is why you want to watch Tyson Fury more than you want to watch Anthony Joshua. And Joshua is a great talent, no doubt about it, but when Joshua was in a similar situation coming back to fight Andy Ruiz, what did he do? He fought cautious, he fought tentative, he didn't, you know, and forget, you know, this is just personality difference, but he didn't do a great job, you know, promoting the fight. Fury did that. Fury said, you know what, I'm going to take a risk, and I might get knocked out by taking this risk, but I'm going to give the fans a show. I'm going to win definitively. I'm going to show that I believe in my skills. Joshua was afraid of Andy Ruiz. There's no question about it. An out-of-shape guy who was 20 or 30 pounds overweight. I think that that shows the difference between those two guys. Fury believes in his talent, believes in his ability, and knows, you know what, I am good enough to make this work. Joshua kind of doesn't have that same confidence in himself. And I'll tell you, if you only had money to buy a ticket to see one of the two of them, there's no question right now who the majority of people would rather watch.
No doubt. Kevin Ioli is my guest. Kevin, how do you explain a 6'9", 273-pound man moving the way Fury moves?
He is a rare athlete, but, you know, he comes from a fighting family, and he started young, and I think that's part of it. It's kind of like Floyd Mayweather. You know, Floyd Mayweather was 18 years old, and he had gloves on his hand. He was in the ring for the first time at 3, and I think that's a similar thing with Tyson Fury. His father was a fighter. Other people throughout his lineage had fought over the years, and he just grew up with boxing, and, you know, when you learn that early, that footwork, those movements, even when you become so big and so overwhelming where you think that he would be bumbling and stumbling around the ring, you're able to make those movements, and he understands boxing at such a high level, and he looks at it differently than anybody else. It's almost, to me, the comparison I would make, Jim, is the way Wayne Gretzky used to see the plays happening on the ice when he was in hockey. It was almost like Gretzky was watching from the press box, seeing people move, and I think Fury has that kind of sense of movement in the ring. He understands, if I do this, he's going to do that, and that's going to be the result. It's just brilliant, and I think it comes from a lifetime of being involved in the sport.
Really interesting. Like, Gretzky knew where the puck was going to be before it went there, so maybe Fury sees things before they happen. But let me ask you this. You can explain that like that, but how do you explain this? It was not that long ago, and you've written on this, that Fury was 400 pounds. He was abusing drugs and alcohol, battling depression. He had suicidal thoughts. How do you explain this dramatic a turnaround and this quickly?
It's almost impossible. I mean, that is so remarkable, and I think it's just a testament to the person that he is, and I think it should be a symbol to people who are suffering. I mean, hey, I think one of the reasons this fight caught on, hey, there are two great fighters who had contrasting styles and were exciting fighters. That's the main reason. But you know what? They also related to people on a human level, because both of them, I put a story out, I interviewed Deontay Wilder last month, and he admitted he had a gun in his hand, was thinking of committing suicide when he was 19 years old. Tyson Fury, you know, not only did he have suicidal thoughts, Jim, he was in a sports car going 150 kilometers an hour thinking of driving into the side of a bridge. So he actually was taking action, and then he said a voice spoke to him and said, don't do this. And so he put on the brakes and managed not to wreck his car and survive, and he sought help. And the fact that he got help from mental health professionals also is so good for other people, because it shows, you know what, there's help out there. Even when it seems like it's the worst, there's help out there. But it's a remarkable story that he's done. And I have no doubt that there will be books and movies written about this long into the future.
No doubt. Kevin Ioli, my guest. Kevin, what was your reaction when Jay Deese let the world know that Mark Breland was the guy who threw in the towel?
Well, I had two reactions. Number one, I was stunned that he would throw his longtime partner under the bus like that. And number two, I thought it was classless. Mark Breland absolutely made the right call. When you're hired as a fighter's trainer, these guys are warriors. They don't want to quit. They're going to keep going. They always believe in their ability. They hire you as the trainer to protect them. They need you to make the call that they don't want to make. And Deontay Wilder had no chance to win that fight at that point. And I think from the fifth round on, Jim, his legs were gone, you know, so if you don't have your legs as a boxer, you're not going to win. And he didn't have the power that he originally came into the ring with. And I think the fact that JD would throw Mark Breland under the bus like that was reprehensible. And I think he did it because he was just trying to kiss up to Deontay, because Deontay has the attitude, hey, I don't want you to stop my fights. But that's the trainer's job. I see my guy getting beaten on. He's taking right hands. He's taking left hooks. He cannot defend himself. He's going to have head trauma if this fight goes anymore. Mark Breland did 100% the right thing, and JD should be ashamed of himself.
Kevin Ioli with some strong comments. I agree. Mark Breland, first of all, if anybody would know, it's Mark Breland. He's been in that spot before. And number two, it's not a matter, Kevin, of him quitting. The guy showed compassion. He was looking out for his fighter. And to me, that was actually a courageous thing to do, because he had to know he was going to take heat, and he has.
Right.
So what do you make of now Deontay Wilder? You never really know how a fighter is going to respond to their first loss. So if you had to guess, how do you think Deontay responds to this?
I think Deontay is a winner, and I think Deontay is a true professional, and I think he'll come back strong. I think if his team does him a favor, they would advise him to turn down the rematch. He will get another rematch, fight with Tyson Fury, there's no doubt. But this immediate rematch, I think, would be a mistake. I think what he needs to do, Jim, is take, you know, 6 months off, no boxing, no promoting, just go out and relax and let his body heal, let his mind heal, and then get back into the gym. And I think that'll do a couple things. That'll open the way for potentially a Fury Joshua fight, which would then create an undisputed champion. And then number two, it would allow Wilder to kind of, you know, work on some things that he needs to work on and just get his body back to full health. Fighters often after a fight like that are never the same, and it's usually because they get back into the gym and they get back into the ring too quickly. If you let yourself heal, you'll be fine. That would be my advice to him. You know what? Don't rush back into this. You'll get him next year. You'll get him down the line, but right now the most important thing is your health.
Kevin Ioli, my guest. So final thought, you shared your concerns about Joshua, but what about a potential Fury-Joshua fight? Just how big would that be?
I think you would be talking, if they put that in Las Vegas, and I think at Allegiant Stadium where the Raiders are going to play, you know, you're going to talk about 70,000 people being there, you know, 30, 40, 50,000 Brits would come over. I think that they could have a record gate at that stadium, or if not, certainly close to it. Mayweather Pacquiao in 2015 had a $72 million gate, and I think that that would be certainly be threatened, if not broken. And from a pay-per-view standpoint, I think it would be massive. It would be a huge event around the world, and I think it's the absolute fight to make. It would be the Ali Frazier of this generation.
But Kevin, don't you wonder about Joshua though? Like Fury, it's very clear that he loved the big stage. He's comfortable on the big stage. How do you think Joshua would deal with that promotion and the build up and the lead up to like the biggest thing ever?
You know, that's not his thing. Like, Fury's comfortable in front of the camera, and Joshua is not. But I also think what's happened is his team has done him a disservice. They haven't put him in. He is a bright guy, and he has a lot to say. He's just not a comedian like Tyson Fury is. But he has a lot to offer, but I think his team just, you know, they protect him, and it's almost like, you know, they're afraid of losing their gigs, and so, you know, he doesn't like to do promotion, so they don't force him to do it. But I think what needs to happen with some of these people is say, hey, you know what, it's only going to be in your best interest, and you're a smart guy who has a good story to tell. Let's set it up for you. I don't know that against Tyson Fury you're going to win the battle of words with him, but I think he could present himself in a very positive way. He's beloved by the Brits, but not so much by anybody else. And I think if the people got a chance to know the real Anthony Joshua, and he would show that side of himself, you know, that would just help his brand going forward, not only in the UK, but in the US and around the world.
Kevin, to me, it's kind of like fighting Conor McGregor. You're not going to win the presser. You're not going to win the run-up to the fight. You're not going to win the promotional aspect
right.
of it, but you might win in the cage. You might win in the ring.
That's what you got to try to do, and you know, present yourself in a good way. That's what you have to do, and I think Anthony could do that. But my guess would be, you know what, he's going to just say, let Tyson do all the interviews, and I'm going to worry about training, and I don't think he'll put his best foot forward.
Kevin Ioli covers boxing and MMA for Yahoo Sports, and again, a good friend of the program. Kevin, thank you very much for that hit, and for all of them, it's good to have you back.
Anytime, Jim. Appreciate you having me. Thanks.
You know, it's a really surreal day here in Southern California when the Lakers beat the Celtics by two in an enormous regular season game, and it's virtually an afterthought because of the celebration of the lives of Kobe and Gianna right now. The memorial is taking place at Staples as we speak, and that was even on everybody's mind yesterday. Bill Russell, for instance, showed up at Staples in a Kobe jersey, which was awesome and sad and everything in between. Celtics-Lakers yesterday was amazing. I mean, they aren't the two best teams in the NBA right now. I understand that, but the game itself was incredible. The Bucks are 9 games ahead of Boston in the East. The Raptors would like a word as well. It's late February. We have a long way to go to get to June. But that didn't feel like Lakers-Celtics yesterday. It didn't just feel like that. It felt like a Lakers-Celtics finals game. Like, rivalries are pretty much dead in pro sports, but that felt like a rivalry game. It felt like one taking place in the postseason, not in the regular season, and not just after the All-Star break. Again, in the East, the Bucks are lapping everybody. They're that good. They're so good that it's easy to forget about them already. But I would not blame anybody who saw that game yesterday and wanted more of that. Like, 7 more of that. If you saw that and said that you didn't want to see that again, you're a liar. Doesn't make you a felon. Not that, but it makes you a liar. I know I'd like to see it. Sign me up for that. Nothing against Milwaukee. But you had two teams trading shots until the very last minute. Regular season games like that rarely live up to the hype, but that one did somehow. LeBron said it best.
Just in the simple fact, just two teams that has aspirations of holding that trophy up at the end of the season. So, you know, we knew what we were getting ourselves into. They knew what they were getting ourselves into, and it was a great game.
Right. And the fact that both teams are in this position at this point is pretty amazing in and of itself. When you consider where they were last year, the Celtics were ripping apart. The Kyrie Irving experiment was failing. Their young players appear to be stagnating. And a season that had so much promise was a total disaster. But as bad as they were still in a much better spot than the Lakers, because LA was going through its 6th straight season without the postseason. LeBron was injured. They had a roster that did not work. The pieces didn't fit. They didn't pull off the Anthony Davis trade. I mean, it was bad. How bad? There was actually a legitimate question as to who was worse, the Knicks or the Lakers. A legitimate question. Not some made-for-TV hot debate. A legitimate question. And not an easy one to answer either. And we were still a few weeks away from Magic quitting to spend more time on Twitter. And now look at the Lakers. Now they're back. LeBron's healthy. And not only that, but playing at an MVP level. LeBron looks about as good as he's ever looked. And they have Anthony Davis. And they have a roster where the pieces do fit. A roster that does work. And they've got a coaching staff that's making all the right moves. Remember all that talk about how when they hired Frank Vogel and they brought in Jason Kidd, it was just a matter of time before Jason Kidd took over? That's not happening either. Nobody's talking about that because that coaching staff is making all the right moves. And now they've got a really nice win over the Celtics. Because that Boston team came to play yesterday, even without Kemba Walker. And if you had any doubts about Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown last season, consider those doubts completely erased. I mean, yes, Tatum, he's got that massive back tat with the slight grammatical error. You can laugh at that guy all you want for that. Except that same guy, while grammatically unsound, just dropped 41 on the Lakers on national TV. And was doing things like this.
Tatum using that screen again by Tice. Shoots over Davis. Knocks another 3 down. Jason Tatum.
He was doing that, and he was doing this.
Jaylen Brown on LeBron James. Pass stolen by Marcus Smart. Ahead to Tatum. One man to beat. Oh, and he throws it down.
And he did this, too.
Lakers briefly had 11-point advantage very early in the game. Tatum spins, gets away, layup is good. Ties his career high with 41 and ties the game.
As LeBron posted on Instagram after that game, Tatum is, quote, an absolute problem, end quote. Really strong praise from LeBron. And LeBron's right. Tatum is an absolute problem. His teammate Jaylen Brown put it another way.
Tatum has reached a new height, man. Superstar 11, we all got to continue to improve and go with him. Like, the way he's playing is unreal. We got to continue to find ways to allow him to reach his potential. He's been playing unreal, man, and it was a joy to watch him tonight.
That's Brown. And it's not like Brown is some kind of hack either. He had 20, 6 boards, and 3 steals. But as good as they were, they still were not good enough. Not when Anthony Davis... Hey, AD, what's good? Not when Anthony Davis is going 32-13. Even in a less than stellar performance. Not when Dwight Howard is giving you 10-7 in 15 minutes off the bench, like he seems to do every single night. And not when LeBron is going 29 points, 9 assists, 8 boards, and the game winner.
He throws it into LeBron on the right side. LeBron one-on-one against Jaylen Brown. Lakers trail by 1. LeBron backing Brown in. 15-foot follow-away. Good! Huge shot by LeBron.
And that's a little dream shake for you, if you need it. It's one LeBron had been planning on using on Jaylen Brown. He had been setting it up all game long.
You know, I've been setting him up all night with the, back down to the drop step to the baseline. So I figured he would sit on it, thinking that I would try it again. So went to my back down and gave a little dream shake to the baseline. Was able to open up middle and get my fadeaway.
Perfectly planned, perfectly executed. And yes, the Lakers-Celtics rivalry appears back. Meanwhile, Milwaukee's going to have something to say about it. I would happily take 7 more games like that one that I just saw come June. Although Milwaukee will have something to say about that, and Toronto might as well. LeBron probably celebrated that dream shake with a salted caramel shake after the game, knowing his nutritional regimen the way we do. Allegedly. You've got Taco Tuesday. More importantly, Milkshake Monday.
Taco Tuesday.
Jordan Palmer is my guest. Jordan, great to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you on. So you and I saw each other in Miami, but now the Combine is getting underway in Indy. What is this time of year like for you?
Well, I've got kind of 2 groups going right now. So my draft guys this year, as you mentioned, Joe Burrow out of LSU, Steven Montez out of Colorado, very intriguing prospect. And then a guy that I haven't heard anybody say a peep about, so this might be the first peep, is Cole McDonald from Hawaii, who left early. Prolific passer, second in the country in yards and touchdowns, and looks the part. And a guy that came onto my radar kind of late, and more I learned about him, more I fell in love. And so those are my 3 draft guys. But then Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, Kyle Allen are out here basically for the entire offseason. Just got done playing golf with Kyle and Josh. And then guys, some of the other guys, Drew Locke and Jarrett Sinn, these guys will come back for certain weeks, and about 5 or 6 other vets. So I kind of have 2 groups going, which is great because the draft guys get to throw with guys who were in their shoes 1, 2, 3 years ago. So it's really more of a community than kind of just me up there preaching football stuff all day.
We are talking to Jordan Palmer. Now, one of the things you've talked about in the past is that the guys you work with are generally guys who have been playing football since middle school or earlier, and this period between the end of the college season and the combine or the draft is the only time when they can really focus on personal development without the distractions of school, team activities, etc. I mean, Jordan, given that window and the right coaching, how much can a quarterback improve during this period?
Well, I'd love to put a percentage on it, which is tough. But, if you think about it, let's take Sam Darnold, for example. And I think he's kind of the normal guy, right? He was really good in high school. He had a bunch of offers. He played another sport. Sam was a really good basketball player. He went on to college, played a big-time ball, went on to the league, got drafted high, and away he goes. Think about his career. So he started playing football when he was little, like most of these guys. But growing up, you play other sports. You got school. You got family. You got stuff. In college, you don't play other sports, but you got a lot of school, you got teammates, you got new freshmen you need to bring along. Most of the time you got new coaching staff, new offenses to learn. And once you get to the league, like my veterans, for example, Sam's not with us today because he's got marketing stuff, right? You get to the league, then you're busy in the offseason. At some point you get married, you have kids, you got life. But the draft represents an opportunity of a couple of months where you have no teammates, you got one coach. You don't have to worry about anything other than yourself. You don't have other sports. You don't have classes. And so I think it represents the greatest window in their entire career for them to really take a step, and not just physically, like with mechanics and accuracy, but also in the scheme of things with, you know, it's, as a person and the sports psychology side, what do you actually think about yourself in terms of confidence, figuring out how to use your platform for good. We do a lot of charity stuff. And so it creates an amazing window for these guys to really take a step. And I've been able to help a couple of guys do that and get blessed to continue to do it year over year.
Jordan Palmer, former NFL quarterback, is a quarterback consultant right now. The NFL Combine's underway in Indianapolis, and we're talking about some of the guys he's working with. Jordan, so what about Joe Burrow? Take me back to last season. What did you think when you watched him play?
Well, for me, it started in June. So I had run camps where I have high school kids come called QB Summits, and it's not an invite only. Anybody can come. And I bring in college guys as my counselors, and it's not too dissimilar from a lot of other camps out there. But I had Joe Burrow. I had heard some things about him, the year before, really two seasons ago. Coach Orgeron mentioned something to me once he went there, and I heard a couple buddies, you know, former LSU guys say, hey, man, this kid's a stud. So not this past season, but the season before, I watched every snap that he played. And outside of LSU fans, I don't know that many people did. And the story was that really the first half of the season, they weren't clicking on offense. They were predictable. He had a lot of drops. Same guys, a lot of drops. And like an abnormal amount of drops. And in the second half of the season, he seemed to, you know, when I watched him, if it was incomplete, well, the ball was in the right spot. Just something else didn't happen. And I think teams are starting to see that on tape now that they're looking at him. But, you know, in June when I met him, I mean, I think he was staring in the barrel of being a sixth-round pick. And but when I got to know him, and I had Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, a couple other guys around him, and they all said, man, this guy's a little different, man. He's a little bit more confident than these other guys his age. He's a little bit more mature than these other guys his age. And after I got to spend a weekend with him, watch him throw, spend time with him, sitting around a fire pit talking, all of it, I realized this guy was on the brink of something really special. I did not know it was going to go like this. I'm not sitting here saying I thought he was going to throw 60 touchdowns and go number one. But I did think this kid's a first-round pick. I said it on some media stuff last summer. And so it really, for me, it started with that. And then once you got two or three games into the season, I realized that this train was not going to slow down. He just played with a different level of confidence that I've seen. You know, you talk about, I think he had seven games that he played in where they were playing top 10 teams, and the result was the same. You know, he'd throw for however many yards and touchdowns you can throw in a game over and over and over again. And then as he started to really have success and started to snowball, which is when guys who are new to it can start to really, you know, buy into the hype or believe what they're hearing or any of these other traps. As we talked about the season, he just did a fantastic job, a very mature job of avoiding every trap that was set for him when guys have sudden success. And he's riding all the way through it. And now he's entering the league as confident as you can be. And he's, you know, he's throwing every day with guys who are in his spot a couple of years ago, and I put some other great people around him as well, and so I think he's poised to have a monster rookie year.
Jordan Palmer is joining us. There's so much to like about him, the way he carries himself, the way he plays, his head for the game, his accuracy. We can go on and on. You can talk for hours about that. But, of course, this is the time of year, Jordan, where people freak out about tiny details, and they look to shred every draft prospect. As an example, Joe's hands were measured at 9 inches. So what's your reaction when you hear that? Or more importantly, what is your reaction when you hear people freak out about that?
Well, it's funny, that kind of the whole hand size thing kind of started when I was playing. I started hearing people talk about it, and I think there's logic behind it, right? If a guy can't grip a football, how does he throw it in the weather? The problem is that we've seen some guys. Jared Goff's got 9-inch hands and like $125 million and a couple of Pro Bowls and a right. Super Bowl appearance. So the problem is there's just been guys that have small hands that have played well, and there's guys with big hands that can't play. So it's not 100% foolproof thing. It's kind of like heights for me. Like, do I want him to be 6'3", 6'4"? Sure. Would I take Drew Brees first overall if I knew what was coming? Yes. So you kind of have to take it with a grain of salt. What I tried to do to dispel that is I've got a little thing where I measure guys' grip strength because I kind of want to dispel that. And it's too early for me to release what everybody's are, but I've been measuring every quarterback I've been around's grip strength, and his grip strength is up there with the strongest. So I don't know if that matters either, but I just look at Joe and I go, look, this guy's the first pick in the draft. You know, 9-inch hands, do I wish they were 10 and a half? Sure. But I just don't think it's enough to concern me outside of just something to talk about on a Monday.
Jordan Palmer, my guest, for a few more moments. All right, so what about Steven Montez from Colorado? What do you make of what you've seen from him so far in workouts? What do you like about him?
Well, I think him and Justin Herbert are going to have the two strongest arms in the draft. And Herbert's been out there with me before and looks amazing. He's got a big, strong arm, big, strong kid. Montez is going to be right there with him, however you want to score it, in terms of arm talent. He's got a bunch of wild throws on tape, and then he's got some head-scratching plays on tape too, like a lot of these guys do. What I love about Montez is that, you know, he played in three systems in a couple of years. He never really got settled. He played for defensive head coaches. So he hasn't really been developed like some of the other guys have been. And for me, that always looks at upside. Whether a guy plays like Patrick Mahomes in a spread offense that's hard to really evaluate, or when a guy's had multiple systems and had to change his philosophy and belief system over and over again at a young age, that can ruin guys, or it can also help you find the diamond in the rough. I think that's what I found. He's an El Paso kid, and I played at UTEP, so not too many El Paso kids are in this position, and so I've been paying attention just because of that. And he's done enough to get you really excited, and I've seen a lot of development in a short amount of time. He's all ball, you know, and he's going to be he's 6'4", 6'5", 230, and can run, and a powerful guy. So I think he's a guy who is just set, almost like a Derek Anderson type player, except he can run around and create time and space. And Jim, you and I have talked about this. I think the future of the game is the quarterback's ability to create time and space. I literally haven't trained a quarterback that can't move because I don't think it works. So Steven is definitely that.
Well, Josh Allen is definitely that too. Jordan Palmer, my guest. Before I let you go, what about Josh Allen? I know you're not going to take credit for all of it, but how much has he grown as a quarterback since the time you first met him, and what does the next level look like for him?
Well, I certainly don't deserve much more than a tad with him. I mean, he's a worker. You know, this is a son of a third-generation farmer. He knows work ethic. He's a powerful dude. He's got to be one of the, if not the most powerful quarterback in the NFL, just in terms of his ability to create energy, whether he's doing that to run or he's doing that to launch a football. To be honest with you, he's ahead of where I thought he'd be at this point. I knew he'd get drafted high. I knew he'd be a guy at some point, you know, a real guy at some point. But I did think it would take a year, two or three. He only played really half of a season last year with injuries. He had that, got hit on the elbow last year and had to miss about half the season. And then this year he had a bunch of new pieces, new running back, two new wideouts, new system. And man, he just took a massive, massive step forward. And what that does to a guy like that is, confidence wise, they start to feel invincible. They start to feel like they can, like, you know, that they're the best player on the field. He certainly was the most powerful and the most explosive quarterback on the field, any field. But now I think he's stepping in, as particularly as this season approaches, he'll be stepping on the field, feeling like he's the best player on the field. And that's when you start to move into that upper echelon of the top couple guys in the league. And the future is really, really bright for him. He's got to continue to take hits wiser. He takes a lot of big hits, and that speaks to his toughness. But that comes with maturity and time. That's not anything I can simulate out here on the driving range. You got to do that on the course. And so I think he's going to take another massive step this year.
Hey, Jordan, one last thought. You mentioned Sam Darnold. He's had some tough luck as it relates to getting mono this past season. How frustrating was that for him? And what do you make of the way he responded to the challenge?
Well, it's not talked about because no one was paying attention, but he finished the year really well. Hit a big win versus Dallas. Played really well in the last few games of the season. You know, one of the things that I told him when he was sick was, you know, in my opinion, the guys who sign the massive second contracts, they don't sign massive second contracts because of the touchdowns they throw and the games they win. They sign massive contracts for dealing with stuff, not necessarily specifically mono, but dealing with that and the Monday night debacle with the ghost comment and the New York media jumping on him. They get paid the massive contracts for handling those seasons of life and then throwing touchdowns and winning games. And so I just love the way that Sam responded to all of that. It just shows that they have their franchise guy. They can put everything on him. And as soon as Sam gets a year where he's pretty clean in the pocket and, you know, in terms of buying time, moving around, making plays, Sam's one of the best in the league right now. But as he continues to mature as a player and gets more game reps, you know, he's really only played two half seasons. I think the Jets have a lot to be excited about with him, and And I think he's, you know, one of the bright young stars in this league.
Another awesome conversation. He's a former NFL quarterback. He is a quarterback consultant. He has worked with the likes of Deshaun Watson, Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, Drew Luck, currently working with Joe Burrow, Steven Montez, Cole McDonald, and more. The NFL Combine's underway in Indianapolis. Jordan Palmer, my guest. Jordan, that was awesome as always. Thank you so much. That's how you close the show. Appreciate you.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Bob in Jacksonville. Good to have you, Bob. How are you?
Hey, Rom. I am actually flabbergasted and beside myself that other people can't see what I see, and that is that that fight was so fixed that it's incredible that other people can't see that. If you want to make a lot of money when they have the next fight, I am going to bet all of my money on Deontay Wilder to knock out Tyson Fury in the first round. Tyson Fury is the worst boxer I have ever seen, and Deontay Wilder is one of the best boxers I have ever seen. And you can't beat a guy by throwing one or two punches around, and that's exactly what Deontay Wilder did. He threw that fight, and it is so obvious that I can't believe that you can't see it and other people can't see it.
So why do you do that, Bob? Just to guarantee a third fight? One that they were already contractually obligated to?
What's that?
They were already contractually obligated to a third fight. Why would they need to fix it?
Because the next fight is going to be a first-round knockout, and whatever Nevada pays for first-round knockouts is going to be, the odds are going to be incredible. And do you remember the Max Baer Primo Carnera fight when Max Baer's manager bet $10,000 that he was going to knock Primo Carnera out in the first round? And he...
That's not a good call. No.
You know what I remember, Bob?
Like, I don't like that cup.
I remember you being, quote, slabbergasted.
Good night now!